Yes, this is my wife, Janine. We've been married for almost 31 years. July 17th is our anniversary date. And we met at George Fox College, now University, in Newburgh, where the Hess Creek Bridge stands, that whole place. In fact, one of my favorite pictures, this is before we were dating, is, it was our freshman year, right? You're on the bridge. Anyway, it's sophomore year? Well, you tried out for the thing your freshman year and made it your sophomore year. Anyway, she was like one of the greeters for, it had a name that I don't remember. Do you know what it was? Doesn't matter. She was like a hostess for people who would show up for the basketball games. And so remember that bridge, that's the way to the gym. So anyway, the picture is of her and others on my favorite bridge. So that's a nice thing. I don't have a picture, copy of that picture. Actually, I think your old boyfriend isn't in that picture, though, is he? Okay, good. All right, good. Anyway, I was glad that Janine and Joy made the drive out here with me. And Joy is somewhere outside doing something with somebody out there. But she was happy because Janine took her shopping and bought her some things this morning. So she's feeling good right now. So that's good. As well she should. Well, in this session, this is always the most difficult time both to talk as well as to listen. And so one thing that was an option is that we take a group nap. That was an option that I was told that probably wouldn't go over too well if I actually had us do that. But I just want you to know, I just want to put it out there that it is in the back of my mind. So if any of you go for option A during this session, I am going to do is to talk about several other things. And just thinking about this particular topic, a way to get into this is with, I don't know if you technically call this a joke, but it's a story about a kid who was given an assignment to write a paper on childbirth. And so he went to his dad and asked, how is, kind of stammered and started, finally said, well, the stork brought you. Kid kind of looked strange at his dad and said, okay, well, how about you? How were you and mom born? And the dad said, well, the same way. And the kid, kind of scratching his head a little bit more and said, well, what about grandma and grandpa? And by now the dad is on a roll, so he just said, well, yeah, the same way. That's how they were born too. The stork brought them. And so several days later, the boy handed in his paper to the teacher, who read this very confusing opening sentence. This report has been very difficult to write due to the fact that there hasn't been a natural for three generations. So I don't know what that kid's dad thought he was telling. They're just funny kind of, birds and bees stories that we could talk about. And I've probably never told this publicly before, but I've started to say this, so I'm just going to share this. I can remember that question. And my older sister is the one who reminds me of this, about how funny this was, because at the time I was young enough, I didn't know it was funny. But we were in a Denny's restaurant, and we're sitting there, and I asked my dad this question, and my dad, who had an undergraduate degree in zoology before he went ahead and did other things. So he had a science background, thought he was going to be a medical doctor and go back to India. So he starts drawing this diagram on the paper placemat there, drawing this diagram of, anatomy kinds of things. And I can remember just being puzzled at what he was drawing. But the part that I remember was my dad, as the waitress came up, my dad got very embarrassed, and how when you're doing a doodle, you can make it into a different picture? So he made it into a clown face, whatever he was drawing. Anyway, my sister thought that was just hilarious, and she was quite embarrassed. I didn't know it was funny. I didn't know. I wasn't old enough to be embarrassed at that point, evidently. But giving birth, it is an exciting thing. I can remember, about exactly all the parts of that story with my dad, but I can remember when our first child was born, and that was an exciting thing. We were thrilled when Janine was pregnant. I can remember on Father's Day in the congregation at the church, they would ask all the fathers to stand, and while Janine was still pregnant, I stood as a part of all the dads. You know, I figured I was a dad. I just didn't know who my, I didn't know it was going to be a son even. I didn't know who my child was yet. We hadn't met formally, but I knew I was a dad, so I was thrilled. I was excited about all of that, and I remember going through the Lamaze classes back then and how thrilled we were with the sonogram picture and showing everybody, here's a picture of my kid, and just how thrilling all of that was. But there really is another part of that whole experience that's also true, and especially for moms, you'll be able to relate to this part. In addition to the excitement part, there is a portion of this experience that is, well, painful. I mean, I don't know what else to exactly say about that. To those classes, we learned all the right breathing things. We learned all the right breathing things. Are you impressed that I could even do that? Yeah. And, you know, we had our focal point and all those kinds of things. And what I can remember, though, very distinctly, being there at the hospital in Whittier, California, and my sweet young bride, all of a sudden, she was a different person there, and she wanted to hit me or something, at least in a few of these moments. Can you remember any of this? Okay. Okay, you can just verify if I'm close to true or not. I know if we got into a conversation, I know she's already thinking there were other reasons for this besides that you have to visualize this part of the room where the bed is like this. I'm standing at one side of the bed. I'm trying to be very compassionate and everything with my wife. The nurse is on the other side of the bed, and my wife is in labor, and there's a television right here, you know, past the foot of her bed, and they were showing the movie Ghostbusters. And, well, you know, I'd never seen it before, and you know, when you're in labor, you're not in labor all every second. You know, there are moments in between, and so, you know, I'd be laughing, and the nurse was, well, could have been doing anything, you know, but to be fair, the nurse was laughing with me now, but Janine wasn't laughing so much during all of that. Anyway, I know why it is that, do you know why it is? We have some in the medical profession here, why it is that they didn't used to allow dads into the delivery rooms? To prevent homicides. That's why they didn't. And so anyway, what I want to do here is to share with you a little bit, as we're continuing on here with our topics, about multiplication epidurals, giving birth without pain, and other myths. Any church of any size can start new groups. Giving birth to new groups, it is an exciting thing. But an abundance of leadership, an abundance of resources, especially, how do you do it without pain? Well, what we're going to talk about is, over these next few minutes, are several small group multiplication myths, some fears, and then some principles, some steps, some things that can be helpful as it relates to multiplying. First of all, this question. Why would a church want to start new groups? What do you think? Just very quickly. Why would you want to start new groups?
Serve the
Okay. Certain age your members, pardon me?
The age difference, like Ray said, the age difference, so the younger and the older group.
Okay, so when he said serve the different needs of the members of the church, you immediately interpreted that as age differences. Yeah. Did you notice that? Interesting. Okay, good. What else? Okay, so for people who aren't in the congregation yet, that maybe that could help in the adding. Okay, let's hold that. We can come back to that. Okay, so you have different people at different levels, different levels of need, maybe different interests. Maybe different life stages. So you're talking about ages, but there's not only ages, there are all kinds of things that can be different. You can have two people who are the exact same age, but miles apart in terms of life stage and the things that they're experiencing. Okay, more. What do you mean? Adding new information, but also piquing an interest level for different people who might be interested in that, whatever that particular topic happens to be. Why else would a church want to start new groups? Here's a couple things to think about. Have you realized that every group has a saturation point? What do I mean by that? A saturation point. It'd be sort of like, if I were to take this pitcher over here, one of those, and I have this cup here, and I pour water into this cup, there is a point that no more water goes into it. Now, I might use this one that Charlene has in front and put it here, and I'm going to even get less water into my cup. Or this coffee cup, you know, and get even less water in that one. Different sized cups all have saturation points, but they're all different saturation points. And yet there is a point for each cup where it's full. Now, how do you know in terms of groups, if a group is like a cup, how do you know where the saturation point is? Well, maybe you don't ahead of time. Maybe you don't know until you start pouring. And you realize that, you know, our group, for some reason, we always were around 8 people. Or our group were always around 12 people. There are different factors that relate to saturation points. Sometimes, well, honestly, it's the skill of the leader up front. Sometimes it's the size. You know, if you're a group that meets in a living room, how big is your living room? Well, there's a structural reason for a sociological reality. You can't fit 15 people into your living room. And so there you go. That's the space need. Or sometimes it has to do with the age of the group. I can fit 8 adults into my living room, but of course I can fit 25 high schoolers, you know, because they don't mind sitting on the floor and on top of each other. So sometimes it depends upon what you're talking about. Sometimes it has to do with the information, the topic, the content of the kind of group. So if it's a classroom setting kind of group, there might be a different total number of people that can fit. So my point is, there are all kinds of different reasons that can determine the size of the cup, but sooner or later, if you want to keep adding people to a group, you can't. Sooner or later, the only way to create more space for more people to fit into that group is by recognizing that more people can't fit into a group. What you need to do is to start another new group. And that is the way that you are able to connect with more people. Small groups and multiplying groups, we see that this is something that, again, is kind of a biblical concept. One could argue that that is what the task of the early church was all about. They were multiplying groups. They were, whether they called it this right from the get-go or not, they were starting new churches. They were starting new fellowships of believers who met in their homes daily and in the temple courts. Read Acts chapter 2, when it says that they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. They did that in their homes, those things that they were doing. They did that in those face-to-face relationships, but they weren't getting 1,000 people together. Those 3,000 people that came to know Christ at Pentecost, they didn't all meet together every Sunday as 3,000 people. How did they do it? Well, that's what the Acts chapter 2, verses 42 to 47 describes, was how they met together in smaller group kinds of settings. Acts chapter 20, verse 20, a guy named Dale Galloway, who ended up at Asbury, but he was up at New Hope Community Church in Portland, Oregon, and he wrote a book called 2020 Vision, using Acts chapter 20, verse 20. And it's one of those places in Scripture that describes what the early church was doing, both in the big group as well as in their contacts house to house. The smaller as well as the larger kinds of connections. When it comes to small groups and multiplication, it's also a tried and true church historical vitality kind of thing. Every great church movement since Pentecost has involved some form of small group or church multiplication. The early church, certainly. In the early Friends movement in 1689, when the Act of Toleration was passed in England, in one county alone, there were something like 400 essentially house churches that registered officially. It wasn't that they were all born right at that point, but it shows that between 1660 and 1689, roughly during those 29 years or so, all of those house groups were started. You want to know what was giving traction to the rise of early Friends in the middle of those early days of persecution? Small groups, house groups. That's what the early Friends movement was doing. The Wesleyan movement. I mentioned about Paul Yonggi Cho, that 700,000-member church in South Korea. Small groups. It is a massive network of home groups. There's a guy named Richard Myers who did a study back a number of years ago now of a couple of different churches, and he wrote about this. The first, it was an experiment. The first church, he told them that if a Sunday school teacher resigns, don't replace them. Instead, combine them with another class and see what happens. But the second church, he told them essentially the opposite. He said, in every department, add another teacher and add another class and reassign the existing students. 1 year later, the results were dramatic for both churches, but in opposite directions. In the first group, the attendance declined in every combined class, resulting in a decrease in church membership. So the two classes that combined, they decreased down to the size of the larger of the two classes. That's typically what happened. And in the second, all of the classes had grown back to the size of the original classes, resulting in Sunday school growth and really a significant increase in church attendance and membership. Those groups, whether they realized it or not, had a saturation point, and they tended to rise or fall down to that same level depending upon whether they combined groups or whether they multiplied groups. Isn't that interesting? Lots of different reasons for starting new groups. But probably one of the main ones is helping people to find places to fit. Helping people find places to belong. You belong here. You belong at Bangor Liberty Friends Church. But could it be that there are some people in the wider community, if you were to draw a 25-mile radius around this church, are there some people who don't belong anywhere yet? They don't belong in a church yet. They don't have a place yet in Christ's kingdom that they know of. Could it be that the place that God has in mind is for them to connect with Him through the bridge of this church? And if so, how are we going to help them to break into all of your existing relationships? Remember we asked the question, what if this church was twice its size next year? What if there were 200 people? Where are they going to fit? What about all of your friendships and relationships? Do you really have to give them all up? Well, what about new groups? What about new places for people to connect? And how do you get there? Well, that leads to this next question. What hinders churches from starting more new groups? Okay, what do you think about this one? What comes to the top of your mind? What's a hindrance to this happening?
Leadership.
Oh, did you say the same thing? It must be both of you. Brianna and Margaret, we believe you. What else? Where are they going to meet? That kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Potentially. There's a fear, anyway, of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just that one word, change, put a shudder up and down everyone's spine in the room and in all of Christendom, because that is so true. Oh, okay, want to say that a little louder? If you don't mind. Yeah. Yeah, what if it doesn't work? What if we try it and it blows up, throws up, diminishes, whatever. Yeah. Well, here are a few things. Selfishness, that can hinder us from doing it. Leadership issues, we're too busy. Maybe literally we don't have the vision for it. I mean, hey, all of our groups are full. You know, everybody's coming. We got all of our cups here. We got water in all of them. They're all good. Maybe I could squeeze one or two more in there, but you know, we're doing good. We're doing good. All kinds of fears. How about this one? We're comfortable. We love everybody. We like each other. We love each other. Why do we want to mess that up? Okay. Well, here is some mythology that I'm going to share with you. These are things that are not true, okay? So some group multiplication mythology. The first one is that starting new groups should be painless. I mean, this is a really interesting concept, because we know that in other things, like giving we know that every birth has some pain, yet there are a whole lot of mothers in this world. Have you noticed that? It's kind of an interesting thing. Suppose there technically is a way for a new birth, a new start, to be painless. I mean, if you could do the Adam and Eve trick all over again, maybe that's, I guess we don't know a lot about some of those details, but maybe there's some. Even when you start a new group with leaders who are in it and everything's part, there are emotional attachments that and relationships to people like it. Years ago, I can remember at our church, we struggled with this. We were trying to figure out, how can we get past this? And so we started a group with 10 leaders. 10 people who agreed ahead of time were going to be in this group to learn how to be leaders of a group, and then we will leave and go start a new group. 10 people. A group of leaders. I got to tell you, it was painful for those 10 people to leave that comfort zone of that group. Why? Because it turned out that they liked each other. And they enjoyed meeting together. And they established new habits and patterns and friendships. And they didn't want to leave it. And so finally, I mean, it was like, you know, throwing a stick of dynamite in there to blow that baby up and to get them to go ahead and follow through. And we were able to get them to start, each of them, all 10 of those, did start a new group. Guess how many of those 10 then in turn started the next level of groups? You're right. None of them. None of them. Why? For the same reason that we had trouble getting this group of leaders to leave in the first place. This is back when we were first learning some of these small group principles and didn't exactly know how to confront this or deal with it. They all loved each other. It wasn't a bad thing. Everyone in the next level of groups liked each other. They loved each other. They didn't want to leave. In fact, there are still a few of those groups that are in existence today, and this was in the mid-1980s when we started those groups. So they're coming up to 30 years old, those groups that are meeting. And the reason why there aren't 10 of those groups still meeting, because not because they tried to multiply and failed, it's because some of them went to heaven. You know, they died, and others moved away, and it was just natural attrition. Starting a new group should be painless. That's what we think should be the case. And yet, when it comes to giving birth to a child, why is it that a mother, particularly one, okay, you said there are 4 kids. I know different ones of you have had, you know, more than one child. Giving birth the first time, okay, we say, well, you didn't know any better. But the second time, why do you do it again? I want to submit to you, and this is a very important kind of a concept here. I want to submit to you that no mother in her right mind gives birth a second time because of the pain. Now, maybe if they're out of their mind, but no one does it on purpose because of the pain. A mother gives birth because of the joy of the baby. It's not focusing on the pain, it's focusing on that picture of the child. That becomes the motivation. It's the love of the child. It's the love of the baby that we focus on that becomes helpful. Well, here's another myth. If it's natural and God wants us to start a new group, it should just happen. Or it, at very least, should be easy. Well, okay. It's true that some parts may be easier than other parts. But there is something that we love and really care about, and this is true for anything in your life. You work hard for it. If you want to go see your son in Massachusetts, you figure out, I'm going to get up and I'm going to drive a truck at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning, and I'm going to get there to go see him. Why? Because you love your kid. You want to see him. When there's stuff that's important to us, we make sacrifices to figure out how we can do it. And that's true for anything in our lives. How about this? Why do we think that small groups, just because God uses this, why do we think that therefore means that it should be easy or should just accidentally happen? We could say the same thing about evangelism in general. Just because evangelism doesn't happen easily or accidentally all the time in your life, do you really think that that means that God doesn't care about people coming to know Him? Well, no, of course not. We know that He cares about people coming to know Him. How about, too, helping them to connect and be a part of His body? He cares about that, too. But it's okay for us to have some intentionality and planning in it. Just like our fishing illustration, it's not disingenuous to fish when the fish are biting. It's okay to plan for this as well. Well, here's another myth. People who know why it's important won't mind leaving their group or letting someone else leave to start a new one. That is a myth. That is not true. Because the fact is, even people who get it, it could be that some of you are exceptional and really this isn't a big deal for you. But chances are for most of us, if we are participating, act would be difficult for us to leave that group to go start another one. That's the reality, and I'm including myself in that. For most of us, that would be a difficult thing. Janine and I, we've started many small groups over the years, and we've also sent out a number of people from our small groups to start new small groups. Every one of them has had some difficulty involved in it, and some have minded leaving. And by the way, sometimes, do you know why sometimes we don't necessarily want someone else to leave our group? You know, it's not us leaving, but sometimes we don't even want someone else to leave. Do you know why that is? Probably several reasons. One is, what if they do it better than I did it? And what about, what's it going to do to the dynamics of our small group? You know, when one person doesn't show up in your group, the dynamics change, right? And if they're gone permanently, then it's permanently changed. So again, Isaac's thing about change, you know, it relates to this. Okay, here's another myth. If it didn't work once or more, we are wasting our time trying again. Well, everything that we're talking about here not only relates to starting new small groups, they could relate to starting new churches, you know, giving birth to new congregations. Same kinds of concepts and same kinds of myths. If it's important to us, if this is something that's on, whether it looks like it succeeded or not, it's not always about, quote, the success. Sometimes it's about the faithfulness and the obedience to try. And how do we know? But that maybe us, that thing that we think didn't work that last time we did it, that maybe that was exactly the thing that God used to change someone's heart. Maybe that's exactly the bridge that God used to draw somebody to Himself. Maybe they didn't end up involved in your church or your group, but then they are in the kingdom today because of your faithfulness. And who knows, maybe that is going to stir someone else up to start some other groups, to connect with other people. Churches that have strong multiplication efforts in many small groups, they must have learned the secret of doing it painlessly. It must be easier for them. Have any of you ever seen any of these TV shows that, you know, where the husband and wife have like 17 kids and, you know, one of those reality shows that, you know, they just got kids coming out every place and they're stuck behind every door? And you know what I'm talking about? Those kind of huge family shows. I mean, do you really think that it's easier for them? I mean, to look at them, we marvel and go, man, they must just be drill sergeants. They've got, yeah, well, it's the older kids parenting the younger ones. You know, all that. Okay. But that doesn't mean that it's an easy deal for them. That's part of why we are fascinated and why they get their own TV shows. It's because we kind of get it, that must be an incredible feat to be able to do something. It's not that it's easier. In fact, and I can testify to this, even though we have started lots of groups over the years, everyone has had an element of pain in it. Because, again, we love the people who are in the groups. Another myth, there's only one right way to start new groups. I'm going to share with you in a little bit an idea or two about how to start new groups, but there are a plethora of methodologies for starting new groups. It's not about the right method. It's about taking the steps to do it, to help people find those new ways of connecting, to help people find a place to be loved, a place to belong, a place to love, and a place to serve. Those are four good reasons. Place to be loved, a place to belong, a place to love, and a place to serve. Helping people to find those kinds of places. There are various ways of getting there. A myth is that it takes too much time. The reason I call this a myth isn't because it doesn't take some time. It does take some time. But if you love something enough, time is exactly what you want to give. When you love a person, you want to spend time with them. If this is something that's close to your heart, this is something that will demand some time, but it's not a too much time. And the reality is, getting more people involved in shepherding and caring for one another and caring for others, that saves all of us some amount of time. It's not Manny shepherding 200 people. It's Manny helping you to shepherd others. And it's breaking it down into smaller groups in that way. Oh, by the way, talking about it takes too much time and thinking about hospital stuff, I can't tell you how many times I was pleasantly surprised in visiting somebody in the hospital only to discover that someone from their small group beat me to it and was already there praying with them. That happened a lot over the years as a pastor. And that is a great thing, because within that small group, I mean, that becomes family, and you love each other, and you're the one. You're the first responders to one another's needs. Well, here's another myth. Once people catch the vision, they've got it. Bottom line, we need to keep reminding one another of this kind of vision, because the tendency, remember, the gravitational pull is towards self-preservation and comfort and complacency rather than staying out there on the front edge. Here's another myth. That a good leader is a good teacher. Have enough of those. Well, I don't know if you feel like you have a ton of great teachers or not here at Bangor Liberty. But what I know is that some of the very best small group leaders are not, I mean decidedly not, the best teachers. And in fact, sometimes the best teachers do not make good small group leaders. Let me say that again. Sometimes the best teachers do not make the best small group leaders. Can you guess why that might be the case? Why would it sometimes a teacher not be a good small group leader? Someone with a teaching gift?
They don't interact well with others.
It's kind of like what I'm doing to you today. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of like that. It's like when somebody in the group asks a question, and this is where it's tough as a pastor. I'm just telling you, this is a challenge for Manny. As a pastor, it's tough for me being in a small group when somebody over here asks a question and all the heads turn and go and look at me for an answer. And that will happen in any group. And the tendency, the temptation, is to answer it, especially if you know the answer. The skill, the learned skill, is to say something like, "That's a great question. What are the rest?" So, that's a great insight. What is some allowing? It's becoming a facilitator rather than the Bible answer man. Now, why is it bad to be a Bible answer man? It's not bad to have answers. I love study. I really do. That it shuts off conversation and discussion. And not only that, but since we're talking about multiplication today, what does that do? What impact does that have on people's mindsets about what it takes if they wanted to start a new group? It says, "I'm not good enough. Yeah, I'm a dummy. I have to I have to achieve the next level. Rick and I were just talking about this a little bit ago. I have to achieve the next level. I have to be David Carradine on Kung Fu so that I can teach you, Grasshopper, to take the stone from my hand. You know, and only when I achieve that level, then can I go start a new group like Pastor Manny. You know, it isn't that way. It's that God can use any of us. In fact, one of the slogans we used to use is that if you can read, you can lead. If you can read, you can lead. And I would add to that, if you can care for people. If you can care for people and if you can read, then there's a good chance that you can lead a small group. Because there's so many great study materials and curriculum things out there, and so anybody can read a question that's written down. And if you can care for people, that's the critical thing, to be able to demonstrate love and care for others, helping them to find their place to fit and belong. Well, another myth. Oh yeah, sure. Sometimes it might depend upon the kind of group you're starting. There are some kinds of groups that need to be information heavy. And typically those are entry-level kinds of groups or ones where it's an experience where proclamation is something that is welcomed and it's okay and you're not looking for a lot of interaction. But those kinds of groups oftentimes are difficult to maintain over the long term. That eventually, if you want relationships to develop, you need that facilitating interaction kind of experience. The sharing of life needs to happen. So not information heavy, but relationship heavy. And there are people who have both gifts. I mean, it's not like you're either one or the other. But those who do have that teaching gift, I really believe, need to look for opportunities to emphasize the caring relationship aspects of their gift mix as it relates to this topic of multiplication. And it, in some ways, it's resisting the temptation to be that Bible answer man and having all the answers. I'm confessing to you that it's something that I have struggled with over the years, that I've had to learn. It's been a learned thing for me. Again, sometimes, though, somebody with that great teaching proclamation gift can be a great fishing pool. So let's say that you know, for example, somebody who knows something about parenting and they're a great teacher. Well, you could offer a parenting series, a parenting class. Well, you start out maybe with some information-heavy stuff. But then there's a shift that maybe takes place, and there's some relationships that start to develop, and you look to ways to morph that into an ongoing kind of a group or a class. Not just an illustration. It could be a lot of different topics that somebody might have information about. What, in fact, just to practice what I'm preaching here, any of the rest of you have some ideas on that? How somebody could have a gift of teaching or the gift of caring relationships. What do you do with that? What do you think? What do you do with that person who has a gift of teaching proclamation in a church? That's exactly what Isaac was saying. a little bit ago, kind of working together. Mm-hmm. It could help. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
Because the ones that just teach, I hear that from students, that they do not
have
to sit and stick to their, lose that relationship.
Mm-hmm. There definitely is a place for giving information, but there's a place for the relationship part. Say that one more
time.
There are lots of different methods that we learn, huh? Well, and learning makes it sound like sometimes it's about the knowledge. And what we're talking about here especially, there is a knowledge component, but there is a relational component. We talk about coming to know Christ as our Savior and Lord, but we also talk about having a relationship with Jesus Christ, right? You notice that? Just even in our language, there's both aspects to it. So we want to grow in our knowledge. We know that that's a scriptural concept, growing in our knowledge. We also want to grow in our walk with Him. Isn't that interesting? It's kind of both. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on here. Continuing to think, we can't birth new groups because there aren't enough people to go around. Okay. So in the first one, it's there aren't enough leaders to go around. And by the way, that before we go on past that, the reason that one is problematic as a myth about the good leader's a good teacher, we don't have enough of those to go around, is because most churches feel like they don't have enough leaders. So, Brianne and Margaret, what you just said, that's most churches feel that way, no matter their size. I mean, we were in a church of a lot of people, and that was still the number one thing that people were complaining about. We don't have enough leaders. But how about this one? There aren't enough people to go around. I'll never forget this conversation that I had with a dear, sweet lady. It was a number of years ago, mid-80s. I was just asked to start some of our adult ministries programs. And at the time, we had about 12 people coming to a Bible study on Wednesday nights. And it had been that way for years. I mean, for a couple of decades. About 8 to 12 people every Wednesday night. Rain or shine, 8 to 12 people. Never many more, never many less, 8 to 12. And had this vision that we would start some new classes, new opportunities on Wednesday nights. And so I sent out a survey, got input from different people. We focused in on what these new classes were going to be that we were going to offer. And I don't remember what all of them were now. I think one was a Through the Bible class. One was a parenting class. One was something else. I don't know, maybe we did a marriage class. I don't remember what all the classes were, but there were going to be four. And I'll never forget this dear, sweet lady coming up to me, who is someone who regularly attended that Wednesday night Oasis Bible study with 12 people. She was one of the 12. Came up to me and said, "Jim, how are we going to divide those 12 people into those four classes?" And she was a little shorter than me, so she's looking up at me. And anyway, I just kind of smiled and said, "Well, Linda, you know, we're just praying and believing there are going to be some other people who might come." And I remember she just walked away. She just knew I was crazy. She just was like shaking her head. I mean, she was polite, but she was not a very opaque person. You could sort of see that she just thought I was young and stupid. And anyway, bottom line is that first week we had something like 100 people come on Wednesday nights, and and never turned, continued to grow. And here's the point, it wasn't just those 12 people. Now, those 12 people still came, but it was just a bunch of other people who weren't interested in just one Bible study that existed for a couple of decades, which it itself had become a small group, and it was hard for anybody new to break into it. Well, that new group, you know, we've now got the four, and all of a sudden there were spaces for new people to fit. And so I suppose a part of that is increasing our vision to be able to see the people who don't exist there yet. Well, here are some multiplication fears that relate to all the stuff we're talking about. I mentioned this one earlier. Here's a very legitimate fear. What if we take the step to start a new group and it fails? What if? Well, to think about this in like human biology terms, I don't know about in your families, but in my own family, there have been some infant and preborn deaths in our family. Not just miscarriages, we've had those, but also my mom, her brother died when he was 2 or 3. Her first child, so it would have been my older brother, was stillborn, died at birth, and he would have been a gem. I don't know what I would have been, but he died. My older sister had a child die in childbirth, the cord wrapped around its neck. So we've had some of those kinds of very painful, tragic things in my family's history. But here's the interesting thing. My mom, my sister, even though for my mom it was her first child, my sister it was her second or third, point is they kept having babies. That didn't prevent them or stop them from still having that vision that God wasn't through with them having more babies. And they did. Thankfully, my mom kept trying so to be here with you today. So what if the new group fails? Well, it is sad. You can't minimize it. It is sad. But that's not the thing that should prevent us from continuing to give birth, from continuing, because it's not about the pain. It's not even about the sadness. It's about the joy of the baby. That's why, again. Well, here's another fear. And by the way, again, these are all very legitimate fears. What if it succeeds? I mean, okay, what if the new group fails? We take the risk, we send them out, and it flops. Okay. But what if we recruit a leader, train a leader, send them out, and it succeeds? Why is that a fear? Do you think? Oh, yeah. What if more people go to that group than to my group that I started? And I'm the pastor. Well, I can tell you, I didn't lead the largest groups when I was pastor. And there's something about that that is, what if the new group succeeds? Could be a threat. What if it feels like it's the new happening place? By the way, that's a fear for starting new churches. That prevents some churches, both of these, some churches from giving birth to starting new churches. What if it fails? We put all the money and resources and then, quote, it doesn't work? Back in the, let's see, it would have been the late 90s, right around 2000, we started a church in Draper, Utah. It got up to around 100 people and existed for 7 years and then had some financial kinds of issues. And the pastor was bivocational, ended up, he lost his job. Well, that, you know, was pretty difficult to continue to maintain. So that church ended up closing. Well, I know that there's some people who look back on that and say, it flopped. It was a failure. I just don't feel that way. I believe, I know that that was a huge success, that there are going to be people heaven someday because of the faithfulness of people, sacrificially, financially, because of that family, the pastor couple that went in and did a parachute drop to start that church. Fantastic. Yes, I know that Draper Friends Church doesn't exist today, but it's a little bit different. I just have a little bit different perspective on what is a failure in that. But what if the new group succeeds? I know that there are churches that don't start new churches because they're afraid of the threat it's going to be to the mother church. We started two new churches out of our church at Rose Drive, sending out, in our case, we had a few more folks in our area, but we sent out $500,000 and 150 people to start one congregation 9 miles from us. Several years later, we started another congregation, similar method, but only 4 miles away from us. Time went on. We had people from the mother church leave to go to both of those different churches, two opposite directions from the mother church was. And I know that there's some people who, again, lamented, wow, the church succeeded, almost like we shouldn't have done it. Using that to reach some people for Christ that we would have never been able to reach. That's the whole point, is that it takes all kinds of churches to reach all kinds of people. There's some people that Bangor Liberty Friends Church will reach that no one else can reach. But there are also some people within that 25-mile radius of this place that Bangor Liberty will never reach. And that's why we need other good, strong, evangelical churches in the area to reach them. Same idea with small groups. You need more small groups because it takes all kinds of groups to reach all kinds of people. It's okay if you can't reach everybody in your small group. It wouldn't be small anymore anyway. Your cup would overflow past the saturation point. So here's the next question, though, that leads out of that. What if the mother group suffers and dies? Well, I have never yet personally seen, and I've, again, been involved in starting or helping to lead the starts of lots of new groups over the years, I've never yet seen a mother group actually die from giving birth. Although I have seen lots suffer, or at least have some element of pain. But what I have seen is if they continue to practice what they know, the mother groups do continue to grow. And so here are some basic principles for another picture of our the one of Elijah. Yeah, he's a smiley kid. He really is. It's kind of funny. Anyway, multiply groups by multiplying leaders. This is just a great principle and concept. We think about we want to start new groups. I would encourage you to think about identifying, equipping, releasing leaders. There are lots of different ways to do this. This is not the only system, but let me just share with you one of the things that we found to be helpful. I already mentioned to you the method that didn't work so well, where we had the 10 leaders who then left to start 10 new groups. That didn't work out so well, long term anyway. Better was when we adopted this method, and that was to have three kinds of people in every new group that we would start. A leader, what we called an assistant leader, and then a host. Leader, assistant leader, host. Those three form the nucleus of every new small group that we would start. Each of those had a different function. The leader would be the one who would gather people together. They would lead by reading the material, the discussion questions. The leader was the facilitator of the group. The assistant leader sometimes would do that same function, but other times they would be the ones to at least open in prayer or lead in the prayer time. The host was the person who had the group in their home, or if the group happened to meet at the church, they were the one that was in charge of, like Margaret would have been the host of this gathering, because when we were all talking in here, she was in the kitchen. That's the function, the host does that. The host made sure that the chairs were all set around the table, or that adequate seating was in the living room. That was the host's job. The leader was never the host, or at least there were a few exceptions, but that was the way that the aim was always to move to where you had three different people as well as three different functions for various reasons. One is because you always had in the nucleus of a new group, or in the leadership structure of the new group, the nucleus for the next new group. So after a given period of time that ranged from 6 months to 2 years, either the assistant leader would leave to start a new group, or the leader sometimes would leave and promote the assistant leader. We did that several times. Or sometimes even the host would move into one of those leadership roles, and so then you find new people to fill in, to backfill the leader, assistant leader, or host roles. But right from the very first time that you meet, it's identifying with everyone in the group that these are the roles these people have. And so it plants the seed from the very first time a group meets that this group exists to multiply, and we will be starting a new group in the days ahead that will come out of this group. And isn't that an exciting thing? And I mean, you share it that way. Isn't that an exciting thing? And after a while, heads start to nod. Yeah, I guess it is an exciting thing. So that's something else you learn how to do, is to nod and say, this is an exciting thing that we're going to be multiplying groups. Yes, it is. Keep nodding your heads. So there are a variety of methods, and I mentioned these. Assistant or host leaves to start a new group. The leader leaves to start the new group. You start a new group from scratch. This is how you get into it, where someone in a church leadership structure will recruit all three of those pieces, the leader, assistant leader, and host. And then sometimes you can start a superhero group where everyone in the group has the potential to be a leader, assistant leader, and host. And you've identified all of those parts in that way. Now, here's something just a little for you, and we learned this through some trial and error, but that is to avoid the S and the D words. Almost, you know what the S and D words are as they relate to this? Split and divide. You got it. Split and divide. I mean, literally, this might be the only kind of a context in the church setting where we would talk about those words. Never in the context in our group, because we don't want to split our group. That is death. Nobody wants to. I mean, think how violent that sounds. You know, we're going to split, you know, the Solomon baby. We're going to split the, you know, no, we don't split groups. We don't divide groups. We multiply. We add. This is these are strategic terms. You know, words are, use linguistic much, words are symbols of meaning. They are for all of us. And as symbols of meaning, they are powerful. They not only communicate a concept, a truth, there are emotive parts that come with many words. And the words split and divide have emotions with them. And nobody wants to be a part of a church split any more than you want to be a part of a group split. But wow, how about multiplying? How about giving birth? How about adding? Oh, okay. It sounds little, but it's a big deal.
Going back to the fear of success.
Yeah.
How do you get past the folks who will identify multiplication with the S and D words? In other words, you know, this is definitely going to hurt us because we're so small, and if we do this, we're going to be smaller. And it's, you know, you can even say it in a staying away from the S and D words just by saying we're going to multiply. Well, that means, like your group of 12, how are these 12 people going to fill four groups? And that mindset is in the church, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I don't know your church well enough to know if there are some buzzwords that you need to avoid. There probably are, and I just don't know what they are. Whatever those words are, it's okay to avoid them. So, but then what you need to do is don't avoid the concept. Find the other words that aren't as immediately defense mechanism inducing, but continue to promote the concepts in whatever ways. Because, and a part of the concept, though, is we're not saying that this is painless. We're owning that. But in the same way, that's why I like the childbirth illustration. I like what you're doing. That's why they're there. Whatever the it is that they like, that's why they're coming. Now, some of them you could do anything. I mean, you could have bad everything and they would come to Bangor Liberty Church just because, you know, well, this is my church and they're not going to scare me out of this place. And, you know, we can move to a different location. This place could burn down and I'm going to come because that's what I do. You know, okay, there's always some people who are like that in every church. But, where's I going with that? Oh, I know. But for some people, the reason they're at your church is because they're in a certain group. Or it is because of what is taught in a certain small group over here. Well, okay. Sometimes what you can do when you recognize that, it's to go ahead and allow whatever it is, whatever that group happens to be, you don't have to blow up every small group to start multiplying new groups. Sometimes what you do is you can allow those groups to continue, but put your energy and your time and thought and creativity into the new things and let those things, especially if they are mature believers and they want to continue, and what you do is you bless them. God bless you. We truly, genuinely, you're released to keep doing what you're doing, but then we're going to put our energy over here. Expand, not threaten, is a way that we've gotten a lot of mileage out of this concept over the years. Well, let's see, just to go on here, because we need to quit pretty quick. Few things specifically for the mother. Create a positive environment for birthing. This is that whole thing of nodding your head in the right direction. This is the thing of helping to shape some new meanings to certain words, like multiplication, like giving birth, like starting new groups, that this is a good thing. So it's right from the beginning, you believing it, you have to believe it in your heart first, but then communicating that as often as possible. It's creating a positive environment for that giving birth. It's identifying a leadership team. This is something that a mother group can do, is to be on the lookout for who in your group could potentially be a leader, assistant leader, or host, or however you want to structure it, of a potential new group. Remembering that they don't have to be Billy Graham or, you know, the next greatest professor to be able to lead. If they love people and can read, chances are God can, or whatever. Maybe it's, you know, they are great in the kitchen or great at just, you know, being aware of people in a room. They could be wonderful hosts of a group. So the mother can be on the lookout. And then, this is a great thing that we learned. When it comes time to launch the new group, commission them like missionaries. What do I mean by that? I know that you've sent out some missionaries from this place. That's part of your history. I don't know the last time that you officially commissioned missionaries from Bangor Liberty. But what I know is that when we do it as believers, we sort of have an idea of what that means. We generally bring them, lay hands on them and pray for them, and we celebrate it, and we authenticate it, and we make it legitimate and real and important, and we all feel good about it, even though we know that they're leaving for Africa or wherever it is that they're going to go. Same thing with your small group. That's a healthy, positive thing, both for those who leave as well as for those who stay. And then celebrate the birth, because notice I blew that picture up right there. Because it is something to celebrate when a birth happens. But don't miss out on that. It's not just the new group celebrates it, it's that the mother group needs to celebrate the birth of the baby group. What we would often do when we would launch a new group is that the mother group would literally go to the new location where the baby group was going to start the week before the preview night of the new group. And we would go there, and that's where we'd have our prayer and commissioning time for the new leadership team, and we would have a party out of it. And we would pray for them and laugh and tell stories, and that would be sort of our farewell send-off. And then next week, when they had their first introduction, get acquainted night, the mother group, we would be waiting to get a report for how this group went. And then we would celebrate what happened there. It's that, anyway, celebrating. Okay, what about for the baby? Meet together as a leadership team to pray, plan, and brainstorm prospects. Choose a birth date. I recommend, if you plan to have an ongoing small group, and I'm not talking about a group on a Wednesday night at church where you're going to learn about eschatology, and it's a six-week class, and you know you don't have necessarily an interest meeting for that. But I'm talking about an ongoing kind of small group. To have an interest meeting, that is the, quote, birth date. Let's say it's going to be next Tuesday night. Oh no, we're going to have a Saturday night group. We're going to meet at 6 o'clock, and the group meets for an interest meeting tonight. Well, next week would be the first night when it actually meets. See, it's important to have your interest meeting same night and the same time as when you will have the regular group start meeting. Why? Well, because you know it's sort of like a self-selecting thing. If anybody can show up on Saturday night at 6 o'clock, chances are they can come next Saturday night at 6 o'clock. Or if your group wants to meet at 6:30 a.m. on Friday mornings, like I had a men's group for lots of years, well, if you have your interest meeting, if you want it to be on Friday morning at 6:30, make sure your interest meeting is Friday morning at 6:30. Okay. Send or make personal invitations. The more personal, the better. Make follow-up calls. Whoever does come to your group, make sure that you are doing like that Sunday school teacher who made a personal contact with them during the week. And then at the interest meeting, let them know that you plan to start that following week. There is something, people like to get in on the ground level of things. That's something that I've learned over the years. And I don't know if that's true here in this part of Iowa, but my guess is that it's true just about any place. That it's tougher to get into something 8 weeks down the road than it is to be a part of the beginning, because then we're in. Our plane has landed. We've connected. We're a part of it. And so here's the thing, by having an interest meeting and then saying the next week is when we're really beginning, notice, you got two beginnings, right? And then, you know, come back next week. It's only our second week. Yeah, we're just getting started. I mean, you can milk that for, you know, your whole first month. This is our first year of group. However long you want to milk that. And then certainly praying a lot and to keep inviting new people. The way that you will keep people is the same way that you won them. And sometimes when we talk about fishing pools of people, our tendency when it comes to group issues is that whoever showed up the first week, we think that now that is our fishing pool. So if 8 people showed up your first week, you think that's your maximum size. Well, it might be your maximum saturation point, but there's going to be attrition. Those 8 people won't stay, and so the 8 will become 6, will become 5, will become 4. What you need to do is to continue to realize the fishing pool isn't the water that you poured into the cup, it's the water that's still in the pitcher that you used initially. It's still all of those people in a wider target area that you're trying to reach. So it's continuing to fish in the bigger fishing pool. Don't allow your small group to become the end game of your fishing pool, but allow it to continue to be a larger thing. Well, I know we were supposed to be done a few minutes ago. I think I heard the outside limit was 2:30, so maybe we're still 4 minutes early. But just before we quit, any questions or comments about multiplication, epidurals, the making disciples things we talked about before lunch? Yeah.
idea. How do you keep the people, I mean, you allow that to continue because it's something they enjoy. How do you keep them from feeling like they don't care about me anymore than just told me to go do my thing?
It's very personal. My answer to that is it depends upon the people that we're talking about. And so the important thing is relational, probably, not informational. It's letting them know that you really do love them. And in fact, that is why you're encouraging them or allowing them, whatever, to continue to meet. It's because you do love them, you do care about them. So I think it's not going to be informational as much as relational that makes that work. I think it could turn upside down really quickly if it's dependent upon who the people are, dependent upon the relationships. But it can also be affirming to them. And in fact, I will say this, there have been some people over time where we've allowed them to be in a group that just continued and we blessed them, we loved them, but we gave our attention over here. Sometimes there are people who are in those groups who with time say, hey, you know what? I get it. I see what they're trying to do over here. I'd like to be a part of that too. And so maybe the vision is that eventually maybe someone from that group might leave that mother group like a missionary to go and start a new group over here. And then everybody gets to celebrate. And then that way, that original group really does fully get to share in the excitement and joy of everything that's going on in the church, even if they're still doing what they've been doing for 20 years. Because they've sent someone out. Yes, that can happen. That can happen. And here's the thing. You remember in one of the videos, the guy that was giving the very foreboding, negative kind of appraisal of Bridges saying, well, gravity always wins. Bridges always collapse. Well, you know what? That's true for groups. Groups always, they do have ending points. And for some it's very quick, for some it's attrition over time, either by death or moving or something. And so it's recognizing, you know, that's okay. And there is some sadness. There's sadness anytime there's change. But if we can keep our focus on what's ahead and the joy of what's ahead, then the sadness, it puts the sadness into its proper context. It's the God, the context is that God loves everyone and that there are more people to be reached. And that we don't want to get stuck in our rock gardens singing our rock songs. We do want to be out in the ocean waves and reaching more people. And isn't that exciting? Couldn't that be thrilling that God could use us to reach those people? Yeah, yes, nodding your heads. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, but that's the kind of thing that we have to... There is some sadness, but we keep pressing on because what a great adventure.
Oh. About that situation. Do you know if those 12 found one group they wanted to join or if they did scatter into more groups?
Yeah, in that particular illustration, the 12, this is before we learned the expand not threaten concept. Yeah. And so that group did not continue at that point. Yeah, a little bit different question I was answering. I think that all of them did end up getting involved in one of the different groups. They continued with others, but not together. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and at that point, we didn't actually give them the option of continuing together because I hadn't come across this concept at that point, but I don't know, maybe we would deal.
Right, probably. If they did find another home, in a sense.
And they did.
Right.
Yeah, there was no one who left to find others to be a part of. I do know that. That's interesting. Hey, thank you. I know we've been going for a long time. We're not heading out of town yet. For good or for bad, you get us tomorrow. And so we're going to be, I guess, wherever in some during the Sunday school hour sharing, we're going to pick up our theme, talking about the person who builds bridges in the Sunday school hour, and then we're going to talk about some of the problems and challenges. That's how we're going to finish up during the worship service. So thank you, and let me just close in prayer for us. Lord, thank you for the privilege of being a part of your family. And I thank you for these, my new friends here in this room. And I pray that you would lead and guide each of them, even as we're thinking about how to apply some of these concepts and what parts fit and what parts don't fit. And what, Lord, I pray that you would help each one to filter out the things that don't connect. But Lord, I also pray that you would help each one to remember that golden nugget from your Spirit, whatever it happens to be, something I've shared or just something that your Spirit has brought to their heart and mind today. Lord, I pray that you would bring that back to their mind, to their remembrance, and you'd give them the courage and the humility to take the steps forward for your glory and for the good of others, building bridges for you. Lord, thank you. Pray for your blessing on the rest of this day, the birthday party that's coming up, and the things happening tomorrow. Lord, thank you for what you're going to do. In Jesus' name, amen.